You're listening to theoutdoorstation.co.uk.
Walking from Land's End to Jonagh Groats, or Ledjog, as it's becoming known in the walking world, is a trip often talked about and thought about at some stage in our outdoor lives. How long does it take? And what would you take? Could you survive? And what are the various natives like across our land? I've been fortunate enough to talk to several people on these podcasts who have actually done it. And I can tell you that it takes approximately 84 days, you don't need much, and the natives of Great Britain are much better than the general press would have you believe these days. Tonight, I talk with Gail, who on the 15th of April 2008 left Land's End with her husband Mick and arrived at Jonagh Groats a few days ago on the 7th of July. Whilst the rest of us were beavering away at our desks, occasionally stealing a glance at Gail's excellent blog as to their progress, they were out there seeing what Great Britain really has to offer.
It was absolutely fantastic. It was so much better than I could have imagined it would be. We set out, as you say, on the 15th of April to stunning blue skies, and every time I'd imagined how it would be setting out from Land's End, I had it pouring with rain. So the fact that we got blue skies, you know, was the first great thing, and the good weather really continued for probably the first 8.5 weeks. The landscapes we went through is all so completely different from the walking along the coast path, walking through farmland, then up off of the dike and actually seeing the dike itself. More farmland to the Pennines, and that's when it really started getting a bit wilder and more remote, which is great, that's what I like. And I've not had any experience really, or nothing to mention, of walking in Scotland. So again, that was a whole journey of discovery of the place and how big and wild it is. How many mountains there are. It sounds like such a ridiculous thing to say, but when you're actually walking through them, you can see all these tops sort of going off into the distance. And particularly when you get the look of blue sky to see them under. It was incredible. It was a really good journey. Didn't feel like 84 days.
I know that your preference when you do go out, you and Mick, is to go for very, very quiet places and get as much solitude as most of us do like when you sort of get away from the crowds. And this route that you chose actually was probably the opposite from that point of view. You were walking on well-known paths.
We were for some of it. Certainly England, Wales, we were on the more popular areas. We did half of Offa's Dyke, just over half of Offa's Dyke. We did the whole of the Pennine Way. And then we went on the St Cuthbert's Way, and that's a very, very popular walk. But from there on, we actually went through the middle of Scotland and then over to the west coast, and we were going for 7 or 8 days at a time without seeing a single person out walking, which actually surprised me that there were so few people, and you really could go for so long without seeing anybody. But yes, the Pennine Way was certainly one of the busier places in that you're on there for a couple of weeks or so. Met a lot of people up there.
Talking about meeting a lot of people, we must mention to people who are listening to this possibly and finding out about you for the first time that you actually blogged fairly consistently all the way through, and perhaps while they're listening to this, they could do with looking on your blog site. Which is, if I can just quickly read it out, is Gail, spelt GAYLEYBIRD.blogspot.com. Or as I've just found out, you can actually just type in Mick and Gail into Google and you come up in the top heading there. So people, I'm sure, can find your blogging site straight away. And it does make for a fantastic read. I know I gave you some publicity and promotion at the very beginning, and encourage people to support you and to obviously keep an eye on you. But as you were going around, or going through and up the country, as it were, and you were obviously going through various areas where you're meeting lots of different people, did you find that there was a lot of people meeting you that had read the blog that actually were sort of enjoying your journey?
I was really surprised at how many people make positive comments about it. It's actually quite difficult when you're blogging on a very, very small screen, on a very small device in the tent, to know whether you're writing something coherent or whether it's coming across as, and then we did this, and then we did that, and then we did this. So it's actually really nice to meet people who'd read it and get the feedback who said that, you know, it was reading coherently and was entertaining people. Made it feel like it was worthwhile to be sitting there tapping on a very small keyboard each night.
It's a strange existence we lead, don't we, the sort of bloggers and podcasters. You sort of, you're enthusiastic about your subject matter or where you might be at any particular moment in your life, and you do wonder sometimes if anybody's paying the slightest bit of attention.
Yes, and I was also surprised because I didn't get access to a computer for the last 2 months. I was really surprised to see how many people had actually started reading the blog compared to when we set off. It was a big leap. Word obviously got around and people were popping by.
Now, having done this yourself, obviously, I know you did a lot of research. You're a very thorough person, and you did a lot of research about the route and speaking to people who had done it. And I think Alan, you spoke to Alan Sloman, obviously, had done the same sort of route the year previous. What was the sort of most interesting pieces of advice that you were given before you set out?
I probably didn't actually get an awful lot of advice from people. I asked the occasional very particular questions about particular areas of the occasional person, but I saw it more of a journey of discovery that I set out to plan a route, which I did, and I found accommodation everywhere, mainly campsites or places where we could wild camp. Every now and then I asked somebody for a piece of information, but it was more a case of we'll find out when we get there. I think the most useful thing to have found out before we left that was to confirm my suspicion that it would be really handy to have one in 25,000 scale maps for most of the England and Wales sections. And having now done the walk, I certainly wouldn't do it without that detailed map, because just knowing which side of a fence or a hedgerow to be on is really invaluable, and it's just so difficult to try and navigate to that level of detail on a 1 in 50,000.
What preconceptions did you feel that were completely wrong? Because when everybody sort of anticipates any kind of trip, you sort of assume certain things about either yourself or the area that you're walking through. And certainly, England's a very, very, Great Britain is a very diverse place. What any preconceptions that you assumed that you'd be facing that actually never came to pass at all?
I think the one thing that I expected and didn't happen was I expected the whole walk to be a lot harder than it was. I expected it to be a lot physically more difficult, and I expected it to be a much bigger mental challenge. I thought the mental issue was actually going to be the biggest issue, because I know I can go out and walk 16 miles a day and then to go and do it again the following day, but I thought that I'd get to the point where I was thinking I just want to stop now. And that didn't happen, so that really surprised me from the point of view of the entire walk. In terms of terrain and the country itself, I didn't think that Cornwall was flat, but Cornwall is really, really quite undulating. That's quite a shock to the legs when you set out. Off of Dyke, I had absolutely no preconception as to what it was like, and also found that that's quite undulating and really surprising amount of different surroundings it goes through. Really liked Off of Dyke. And likewise, the Pennine Way, I had absolutely no idea what it was going to be like. I've walked a few very tiny sections before and absolutely loved the Pennine Way. It was a really nice couple of 3 weeks. I think that the weather helped with that. And perhaps the biggest surprise for me was the linking the two together between Off of Dyke and the Pennine Way. I expected it to be industrial built-up areas. I didn't expect that we would get so far away from built-up areas and not know that we were really close to them. We were just in countryside like we could have been anywhere in England, and it was all really nice and pleasant.
Well, what's been the overall impression Great Britain has left with you then as an area to walk through for this sort of length of time?
Very, very nice when the sun's shining. It's got an awful lot to offer. It's absolutely lovely villages, great people, lots of green places, lots of wild places, in places that you wouldn't expect to find them. You can go out of a town and then find that you're in a completely open area, you know, no fences, can't see a road, just openness. And that, I think that particularly in Scotland, again, it probably seems like a rather naive thing to say, but I don't think until you actually pass through a place at the slow speed that you really appreciate quite how big it is and how open. The absolute generosity of people that we met on the way. There were people that we'd not even had a conversation with. They only knew what we were doing because of the signs we had on the back of our backpacks. They'd come up to us in the street and give us money. And other people that did just stop for a chat and ask what we were doing, they'd say, "Oh, you're doing it for charity." We'd tell them that we were, and they'd just put their hand in their pockets and give us money. And it was, you know, really surprised me that so many people, completely unsolicited, just threw money at us from Macmillan. It was really very nice to find the generosity of everybody. And everybody was helpful as well. We actually had an incident in a post office when we were desperate for a bed for the night, where the ladies in the post office went to such extreme lengths to try and find us somewhere to stay, you know, at the expense of ignoring paying customers. It was lovely to see the society at its best, you know, the generosity of people towards the charity and the generosity of people towards us.
Certainly in this day and age where the news is all negative news about how awful people are to each other, that's really reassuring.
Yes, it is indeed.
There's been a lot of talk this year, as you know, about access and freedom to roam and wild camping and so on. Now, I know you, where possible, I think you were trying to camp as much as possible, but you obviously use some B&Bs occasionally in facilities and so on. Did you come to any conclusions about the wild camping as a way of travelling in this country?
It would have been absolutely fantastic if we could have wild camped more in England and up off of Dyke. I would like to wild camp where I can. Have so many benefits over campsites. The problem is that I don't like to lie in the tent thinking that some farmer might come and knock on the nylon any moment and tell me to move. So I only like to wild camp where I know that we're unlikely to be found and where it's generally tolerated and accepted. And because I didn't know any of the areas where we were passing through, I think there were only 4 days of the entire route where I'd ever walked before, that made me concerned that I didn't want to just go and pitch the tent on any field or hillside without knowing what sort of area it was. I mean, we can get there and think, yeah, we'll be fine here, but that would have thrown the whole schedule out. So without that prior knowledge, I didn't want to just take the risk, so we stuck to the schedule and we went to the campsites. Scotland was just incredible in that you can just camp anywhere. It was such a nice feeling on the first night we wild camped in Scotland to know that we were legal. We could just pitch the tent. We didn't have to wait until everybody was off the hill. We could, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, pitch the tent, put a cup of tea on, and you know that nobody's going to come and tell you to move. It's for somebody like me who is concerned about doing the right thing and not being told to move on, it's such a benefit to have that wild camping right.
I don't think the people in Scotland realise the benefits that they've got there and the actual psychological difference between that simple line on the border.
Yes, it is the difference between lying in the tent thinking, oh, you know, is the farmer going to come along and be disgruntled versus I can be here.
Did you actually ask anybody if you could camp anywhere? Did you sort of try and do it because circumstances required you to do it?
No, we didn't. We had a couple of places where accommodation was looking a little bit shaky, but our backup team of Google people, Dick and my sister, always managed to find somewhere that we could go. So we didn't actually get to the point of having to knock on a door and say, "Can we camp here?"
And you obviously went with your husband Mick and shared every moment together. How has it sort of affected your relationship?
What was really surprising was we actually managed to get through 81 days without a crossword. I certainly thought that there'd be some disagreements before then. And that one only lasted as long as it took me to accidentally fall in a peat bog when he decided he would rescue me. So it was, as you say, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 3 months in each other's company. And we came out of it still liking each other. So it's got to be a good thing.
It, definitely. Well, you look at things realistically, it's not very often you actually spend that much time with your partner going through an experience like this.
No, I mean, it's... Even in any other situation, it's unlikely that you'd be together 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But yeah, in to actually have shared the whole walk as well, not something that happens every year.
When I've spoken to some other people who have done, as I say, a similar walk over the last few years, it's been interesting to talk for a few moments about their emotions as they sort of ease themselves into. The walk and how different it becomes after the first 2 or 3 weeks and then the sort of chilled out factor that sort of tends to be present in their lives as they travel from south to north. Did you have the same experience as well?
Probably not something that I noticed. I noticed, we got into the routine pretty quickly. It just became second nature to get up, go through the morning routine, pack away, go for a walk, pitch the tent and, repeat. And didn't get fed up with it at all.
Did you not find that things started, you perhaps started with your mind racing about what if, and how did you leave the gas on and all this sort of thing, and then after a while that all disappeared and you just took it each day for what it presented you with?
I actually didn't even start with the mind racing and worrying. Mick was really surprised in the few days beforehand. Usually before we go on even a week's holiday, I'm fretting for days beforehand about whether we've got everything, it's getting all tense about, we've got to pack, we've got to do this, got to remember everything. And surprised both of us on this trip that in the few days beforehand, even though we had a mountain of things still to do, I was absolutely calm, travelled down there without any getting het up about whether we'd locked the front door. And I didn't have any of that, real-world issues once we set off. I was in the mindset of right now we're walking.
Yeah, but as you were walking and talking to people on the way, did you feel slightly divorced from sort of, well, real life in some respects, that these people you were meeting were doing a walk for a weekend and then you carried on and they went back to work?
Oh, yeah, we were definitely divorced from reality. I mean, we could easily go for a week without seeing any news, go for days without seeing anybody. And our reality was that whole different reality where, even to the food substances we were eating is not what you'd live off if you were living in a house. The reality of living in a tent where you can't swing your arms around. We adjusted to it absolutely fine, but it's certainly a different reality to the one that everybody else was living around us.
Mm. I mean, another bit of adjustment, obviously, is the physical adjustment as well as the mental one. And you were both, when I saw you in April, fairly sort of lean people. What sort of changes did your bodies go through?
What I really noticed was, I think we were 3 weeks in. I'm always really slow uphills. I'm okay on the flat. I tend to go very fast downhill, but I'm very slow uphill. It's Mick swears that it's all in my head, and I just think that I can't walk uphill fast. But about 3 weeks in, I found that I could actually keep up with Mick on most hills. So although I didn't think on a daily basis, oh, I'm getting fitter, it was that sudden realisation that I must be getting fitter because I can actually walk for 8 hours without noticing it, and I can keep up with Mick uphills.
I wanted to talk to you because we're literally, I think, probably less than a week now since you've finished. Over that period of time, real life starts to creep back into your routines and so on. If I've got the timing right, what have you noticed different about the world around you and possibly about the way that you're seeing the world as a result of spending 84 days out of it, as it were?
I don't think that there's anything that I'd say that, it's that I notice about being different. It's I don't know if I just let things wash over me. We've jumped back into the real world, and Mind you, I guess we're still living without a television and a telephone and the internet, so we haven't got those modern conveniences at the moment, so we've not really gone as far back into the real world as we might have. But I've not had any sort of real world adjustment that thinking, oh gosh, this is strange. It's very nice to sleep in a real bed, not that I have a problem with the tent, but it is nice to be able to sleep in a bed and lounge around and move your arms around, and we're really appreciating those things.
And presumably putting the kettle on whenever you need to.
Oh, that is nice. We actually stayed on probably 3 or 4 campsites that had a kettle for campers' use, and I don't think I'll ever take for granted again the use of a kettle. It's such a wonderful thing to be able to have hot water at the push of a button.
Yeah, yeah. And we're looking back, turning it around the other way then, is there anything that you're missing at this moment in time, sort of 4 or 5 days after the event? Are you sort of getting itchy feet and feeling like you want to go for a walk again today?
Definitely itchy feet. I'd love to go out there for another walk. Going to have to do a few things around home before we can do that, and before we go for another very long one, definitely going to have to go and earn a few more pennies. But spending 12 weeks walking the length of Britain hasn't made me, as Mick put it, we might get to the end, throw our rucksacks in the sea and say never again, but that didn't happen. Certainly would go on another long walk.
I think it's sort of addictive, this sort of activity. You start one, realise how enjoyable it is, and just want to keep going.
Yes. Mick's not sure about whether he'd want to go on another walk of quite that length, 12 weeks, but I think it's just the foot issues he had, and if he could resolve those, I think that he'd be happy to spend 3 months walking again.
And what about your outdoor ideals? You know, sort of, I said preconceptions earlier on, but sort of the value of living outdoors for a few days or for a weekend or for a week's holiday is always of great benefit when you sort of get back into real life. But actually doing it for this length of time, have you sort of changed any sort of understanding or feelings towards that?
I like the camping. I certainly like the wild camping, as long as it's not for more than... I'd say my limit is probably 3 nights at a time before I want to go and use some proper facilities and have a proper hot shower. And if anything, it's made me more willing to go out for multiple days. My one concern, because our that usual backpacking holiday has only been a few days, I've never had the experience before of having to carry all the food and stay out for days at a time. And having done that on, I think, the 3 or 4 stretches we had through Scotland, I'd be more than willing to in future go out and stay out in the wilds without shops, without any facilities for days at a time. So it's probably made me more willing to do that.
I asked you about what advice you were given. Obviously, with this still fresh in your mind now, if somebody's listening to this, which I hope they are, and they're also having pored over your blog in great detail, what advice would you give to somebody else who's listening to this and thinking, yeah, actually, I fancy giving this a crack?
Go and do it. If you can, if you like walking, I think that's the first thing. You need to like walking. You need to like going for a long walk or fancy the idea of a long walk. And if you've got the time available to you and the money available, go and do it.
Right, so nothing specific, nothing sort of technical, nothing about getting fit or anything like that, just purely just take that one step forward.
I think that there's different ways of approaching it. I went to the nth degree in planning. I spent a year planning this and made sure that I had a campsite or somewhere we could camp or a B&B I identified for every night. I planned the entire route, printed all the maps with the route marked on them. So I went to a lot of detail in planning. Not everybody does that, and although that's my style, it's not everybody else's style. The routes we chose to take, you know, it's very much a personal choice. So I'd say if you want to go and do it, go do it. You don't necessarily need to do anything that anybody else has done before. You don't need to get fit before you go, because by 3 weeks in, you'll certainly be fit. And you can always start off gently to make sure that you build that fitness without killing yourself. But I think the one thing that really did help us, and where perhaps other people struggled slightly, is that because we're quite experienced with backpacking in itself, we've actually, over the years, got our kit choices whittled down to what works for us. So I think although we weren't experienced in long distance walking, because we'd been backpacking a lot, we knew what worked, and therefore we didn't have that any surprises. We didn't suddenly find that something didn't work, something was broken, because, you know, it wasn't suitable. We were, you know, from day one, we were quite happy pitching at a campsite, pitching the tent, going about the routine of cooking, rehydrating food, and that all worked. So I think if anybody was going to go and do it and they're not experiencing backpacking, it's useful to get out there for the odd weekend and make sure that you get a little bit of experience in just the carrying your pack, how the pack fits, where you put everything, and how your tent life works.
Yeah, so all the basics from a camping point of view. Which leads me on to another question, really. I know that myself, possibly a bit like yourself by the sound of it, sometimes I can sort of over-prepare in the sense that you sort of have too many details and too many plan Bs. And as good as that is for sort of giving you confidence, sometimes it takes the spontaneity out of something like this. Do you reckon it would be possible for somebody to say, OK, well, I've got the time and I've got the money and I'm just going to see what happens and actually do a walk like this without any planning at all?
Well, I think that last January, a chap called Dave set off. His blog site was I'm So Dave. And I don't believe he did an awful lot of planning. He did pretty much decide to do it and set off. And there's no reason you can't. I mean, if you're happy to sit down each night the night before and decide where you're going to walk the following day, I think the logistics of getting all your maps might be a bit tricky. But there's no reason that you couldn't just set off if you're the sort of person that's happy to walk into a town and assume that you can find some accommodation. I think from my point of view, the other thing about planning was you knew where you were walking to that night. You weren't going to get to the end of an 18-mile day and then find that you've got to walk around for another 2 miles searching for somewhere to stay. But I don't think there's any reason that you couldn't just set off and do it if you're the sort of person that's happy to do that.
Right, OK. So, yes, that's worth knowing, I think. Now, you mentioned earlier on about logistics and support, and I think you said your sister was sort of always at the end of a mobile phone call, I guess, somewhere with any spares or whatever. Did you have to call on her services much at all?
A few times. There were two people that were backing us up. There was my sister and my friend Vic. My sister was in charge of sending out the general resupply parcels, which contain the dehydrated food and gas cylinders. So every now and then I would phone her and ask her to throw a few other things that we expected to need in. And I think there were two occasions, maybe three occasions, when I phoned her and said, quick, get yourself to an outdoor shop and buy me one of these and post it to me. Only once did we have to get her to overnight something to us. Which was when the Steri pen broke and I got her to send me some chlorine tablets. And again, my friend Vic sent a few emergency parcels. One was the very big emergency of having run out of audio book, and she kindly went and bought an MP3 player and put a new book on it so that we'd have some entertainment in the evenings.
Oh, so you got to a point you were so fit you weren't even tired for sleeping then?
No, Mick enjoyed the audiobooks. I'd put mine on every evening and promptly fell asleep and spent the next night trying to work out where I'd got to the night before.
It's terrible, that, isn't it?
I think my record was going for 5 nights, still falling asleep trying to work out where I'd got to on the 5 nights previously.
So a simple question then. What do you reckon, north to south or south to north is a better route?
Now, that's a very tricky question because I've only done it one way. I would say 90% of the people we met told us we should have been walking the other way because it's downhill. I think we probably got it right going north, just because of the timings, avoiding holidays, bank holidays, and avoiding any problems with stalking season because we weren't following main trails in Scotland. I think if we'd been walking the other way and setting off, I think August would have been a sensible time to set off if we'd been walking south to avoid holidays in England. Then we would have run into problems with stalking in Scotland. I think from the point of view of being able to get accommodation, not being mobbed with people on holiday down in Cornwall, Devon and the popular areas, In terms of terrain, I'm not sure there's a great deal of benefit either way. I mean, it is hillier in Scotland, but Cornwall's hardly flat, particularly when you start your first 3 days on the coast path. And certainly one chap we did meet who was walking south, he said the Pennine Way came as a shock to his system because he'd been walking, he did the A9 followed by the Great Glen Way and the West Highland Way, and he said none of them are hilly routes. So he actually managed to get into England before encountering any real hills. So, you know, the usual advice that if you start in Scotland, you soon get fit. He said his route, you know, he didn't get the hill work to prepare him for the Pennines. So I'm not sure there's any real benefit depending on what your wants are. But if I was to do it again or plan, you know, the same trip again, I would start in the south again.
Just take us spend a few moments, if you would, and just describe leaving Land's End and arriving at John O'Groats, because I think there is both have got nice little stories attached to them.
Well, we left the Land's End with one of the fundraising managers from Macmillan Cancer Support came to wave us off. After we'd left our B&B down there, which was Weaver's B&B at Trevescan, lovely place, lovely owners, and we walked for 84 days, and we arrived at John O'Groats not expecting anybody to be there to meet us, and complete shock to find, literally the minute we arrived my cousin and my aunt to see us in, and, you know, great, we've got four people there, didn't expect anybody, and we've got some family there. And we're just having our celebratory glass of bubbly in the local hotel when somebody else came and found us, complete stranger to that moment, by the name of Steve, who was the brother of the owner of the B&B we stayed in the night before we set off. He came from Land's End, decided 20 years ago that he was moving up to Scotland, and he now lives just down the road from John O'Groats. So that was really quite surreal that, you know, we set off from Land's End with a wave off and having left this B&B, and we get to John O'Groats and meet the B&B owner's brother. I'd say really quite surreal. Two other people tried to meet us at John O'Groats and just missed us. We absolutely route marched on the last day and got there too early for them. So they missed us. But yes, there were three people that we'd never met before that tried to meet us at John O'Groats.
And they'd all presumably been following your blog all the way.
Indeed, yes. We'd actually printed off some little slips with the blog address for anybody that was interested to hand out on the way. And the first one we gave out at the B&B that we stayed in the night before we set off. And she'd logged on and then told her brother about it. And yes, he'd followed our route the whole way up.
Wow,
and,
wonderful.
Yes, all of them had known about us by reading the blog.
Big country, small world, isn't it?
It is indeed. I mean, incredible that somebody that had lived his life in Land's End had moved to literally a few miles up the road from John O'Groats.
Before we talk about gear, two key things. There must be one singular high point and singular low point of the whole trip. Could you just spend a couple of minutes and explain those to us?
Now, it's quite funny because the high point and the low point happened within about half an hour of each other. The high point, and we both agreed that it was one of the best moments of the trip. We'd walked through a forest and it was absolutely pouring with rain. It was a very showery day and we could actually see the rain coming. We'd seen this very heavy shower come, sky went black, absolutely tipped it down, and behind it was more blue sky, and behind that we could see more rain. And we popped out of this forest just as the sun had come through in the blue sky, and we had the most tremendous view of Loch Erricht. And it was just absolutely incredible. I mean, it really made us feel that we were some of the luckiest people to be able to be doing this walk. I mean, practically every day was really good. But, you know, for that moment of having the perfect sky, the perfect view, you know, sun beating down, it was really one of the best moments. It was the best view of the trip. The worst moment was about half an hour later. For me, this is. Mick didn't share my worst moment. We'd actually run out of water that morning, hadn't passed any good streams. I'd actually diverted about half a mile to find a stream. wasn't a good one. That's when I found out the SteriPen had broken. I had no way of doing anything with this rather dodgy-looking water. So I'd probably gone for about 5 hours without any water to drink. And I was very, very thirsty. I was very, very hungry. I was very tired. And I was walking up through a hillside with yet more fallen trees. And for about 5 minutes, I just didn't want to be there. I wanted to be at home. I just had a complete tantrum about it. And absolutely miserable for 5 minutes. Misery then alleviated slightly. And I think we got up to the top of the hill and we could actually see a stream ahead of us that... that was looked a good one, and once I had some water inside of me and some food, and I sat down for a while, I was happy as they came. Walked up another hill, absolutely no problem at all. But that 5 minutes, I wanted to be at home on my own sofa, and I just did not want to be walking the length of Britain. But I'm pleased to say that was the only time in the trip that I really just didn't want to be where I was, and I'm sure the food and water had a lot to do with it.
The human mind is and body is a powerful thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, certainly. Well, let's move on to every outdoor person's favourite subject, no matter what trip you've done. Let's talk a couple of minutes about gear, if we may.
Okay.
And again, I know you're very thorough in your preparation, and as you say, you've got plenty of experience in honing down the gear that you were comfortable with anyway, and you had a last-minute sort of dash around for a few other bits and bobs. But let's explain this to people that perhaps are just sort of picking up on this. The base weight of a rucksack is the weight of the rucksack excluding fuel and food. And looking on your blog again, once more for details, I see that you weighed your rucksack when you got to the end. And am I right in saying it was about 7.5K as a base weight?
Yeah, it was without any water at all, but with my drinking bladder and without any food at all, it came in at 7.5 kilos. That did include a canister of gas.
Okay, and what about Mick? What was his like?
We didn't actually weigh his when we got back.
So he was on his knees. Sorry.
I know he started out at... he's claiming it's 15 kilos. He started out, I think, at 11 kilos. From Peebles, I finally decided to shoulder my fair share and took half the tent. But the 11 kilos included 2 litres of water and probably about 5 days of evening meals and 2 days of other food. So he was probably about 8.5 kilos base weight.
Yeah, which is still very, very respectable for this sort of trip and spending that number of days. Let's talk quickly then. What about could you just briefly describe the sort of the tent system, the sleeping systems, and the cooking systems, so that people can understand the sort of items you took with you?
Well, the tent, we went for a dual approach on the tent. We did the first 3 weeks, just under 3 weeks, with a Terranova Voyager, so your standard British backpacking tent, dual skin, 3-pole, reasonably light, 2.2 kilos. We didn't go with the very lightweight version of it. Then from the third week, we switched to a Stevenson's Warmlight 2R, which is 1.3 kilos, double skin in between the two poles. It's a tunnel tent design. Single skin on the two ends. Goes up very, very easily and with very few pegs. Like that one a lot, but it just didn't feel practical to stick with that one in the north half and the Pennines and through Scotland with the midges and the potential for wet weather. I mean, it'll stand up to any amount of wind, but it was the wet weather that concerned us with two of us in there and not having a separate porch. So from Hebden Bridge, we switched back to the Voyager. Sleeping system, we both had a sleeping bag rated to around zero. Both had a firm rest, full length for Mick, the girl's length for me. And we did take the silk liners, which we thought was probably worth the weight just for, you know, making the sleeping bag not smell so bad, having used it for 3 months. Cooking, we went for a dual approach, but that was a dual approach at the same time that we took the gas stove, Coleman F1 light, and a 250 cylinder with also the bush buddy. So the plan was that we'd use the bush buddy where we could, so that we didn't need to resupply with gas so often. We wouldn't need to carry as much gas as we might otherwise have felt the need. One gas cylinder will last us for 5 days if we make 2 cups of tea and an evening meal each day. So being able to use the bush buddy really just stretched that out.
And did you find that to be as successful as you'd hoped?
Using the bush buddy itself was successful until the last few weeks when it rained a lot, and I really wasn't inclined to sit outdoors in the rain, try and find dry fuel and get the bush buddy going. So it didn't get a lot of use the last 2 or 3 weeks. But other than that, we used the bush buddy a lot. Where it probably, our theory failed us was we still ended up carrying more gas. Because we weren't able easily to find gas on our route, we were having it sent in resupply parcels. It meant that we kept getting concerned that we were going to run out of gas, so we'd get an extra cylinder. And so it didn't prevent us from carrying the amount of gas that we hoped it would.
And the stocks of gas accumulated, I guess.
Yes, yes. But it's still good to have the bush buddy for the fact that it is it's nice to have the fire. It gives you an hour's entertainment in the evening to actually get it going and cook your tea on it. The downside being that you get filthy, and I did have a bit of a habit of accidentally smearing soot all over my trousers.
I mean, as an aside, that somebody's mentioned just recently just how much the bush buddy creates an atmosphere which no other sort of cooking system does.
Yes, gas stove going away is just doesn't do it, does it?
No.
But yeah, having a real fire, and we could also try and convince ourselves that it would keep the midges away.
Yeah, well, did you actually get many comments from other people on the campsites when they saw you using a bush buddy?
Nobody seemed to notice it, really. I mean, the vast majority of campsites, certainly until we were quite a way up the Pennine Way, we were the only people camping. It was really unbelievable how quiet the campsites were. We were very often the only people, the only tents on the campsite. There just weren't people around to see the bush buddy. A few people who did notice it, commented and were interested in it. And a few people actually held it, couldn't believe how light it is, and had a good look and feel, and oohed and aahed at it.
Mm. Well, coming back to your cooking gear then, sort of what pots, pans, mugs, and so on did you take?
We set off with a MSR Titan kettle thing each. Nick also had a titanium mug. I set out without a mug, and that turned out to be a mistake, because when you're using the bush, I find it's a lot easier to actually just keep the bush buddy going, make a cup of tea, and then put the evening meal on. And if I'm drinking out of my kettle thing, I can't be having a cup of tea out of it at the same time. Sorry, I can't be cooking and having the cup of tea at the same time. So we were only about 3 or 4 days in when I decided I needed a mug and went and bought a mug. In terms of utensils, we went with two of the Marks and Spencers for a while did very good hard plastic teaspoons, which were meant to be disposable, but we've used two of those for the entire length, and they're still in absolutely perfect condition. And that was the only utensils we took, was one teaspoon each, which did mean we couldn't eat noodles. they do weigh only 5 grams each. They've proved to be very durable, and we managed not to lose one.
So you had
that worked.
You didn't have like an Oricasso folding plate or anything. You literally just managed with just the pot and a mug.
Yeah, we did. I've actually used the folding plates on previous trips, and I've used pans instead of eating out of the Titan kettle. But no, we for quite a while now we've only ever taken the kettles. And as I say, I ordinarily wouldn't take a mug, but on this trip decided that it was very useful to have one. So, yes, very minimal cooking kit. It was just a stove, a kettle, and a mug, and a spoon.
Right. So you've now got, those are the three systems, the tent, the sleeping, and the cooking, that tend to be sort of, people tend to sort of overdo their requirements, possibly. I was surprised that the sleeping bag was a zero bag rather than just something a little bit warmer in case you caught a last-minute chill.
Well, we did get down below freezing one night, in that we had quite a heavy ground frost one night in Scotland, which caught me a little unawares. I woke up in the night really quite cool. So I got up and put some socks and an extra top on and a hat, and perfectly warm then. And Nick sleeps warm anyway, so he was perfectly happy and hot in his... he's got a RAB 250, Quantum 250, and he was perfectly warm in that. I think my bigger concern was whether I was going to be too warm in it if we caught a warm spell, because I went with the PhD Minim, which doesn't have a zip. So I didn't have that venting option, and a few nights I was a little bit too warm, but on balance I'd say it was the right choice. I was at no night could I not sleep because I was too cold, and at no night could I not sleep because I was too warm.
Well, that's a good balance then, certainly. What about the clothes then? Just briefly, how would you describe your wardrobe?
very samey. I didn't take a spare pair of trousers. Mick took a pair of Montane Featherlight trousers just to wear around a campsite if he wanted to. So we had two T-shirts each, one long sleeve, one short sleeve, one pair of trousers each, a wind jacket and a waterproof layer, and a down jacket each. And that was our wardrobe. So it was... we didn't feel like we were clean the whole time. We didn't feel like we were fashion conscious, but it did the job. I went into pubs for a meal covered in soot and mud and wearing the same trousers I'd worn from the previous week, but I didn't really much care if anybody stared at me, so I was just glad not to have the extra weight of an extra pair of trousers.
And I presume that when you threw them in the washing machine at the campsite, they soon came up clean again.
Oh, well, I'd like to think so. Don't get me started on those washing machines at campsites. Speed queens, don't get your clothes clean. They get the worst of the mud off, but I wouldn't say that my clothes were clean until they went in a proper washing machine 3 days before the end.
So that's the clothes then, the cooking, the sleeping and the tent. I presume you've got the few basic accessories like a head torch and so on. Just very briefly for anybody who's interested in doing something like this and blogging, just could you describe your blogging system, the electronics you took with you?
My blogging system was very simple and very low-tech. I used Pocket Mail, which is the very same device that Judy
Armstrong
used on her Alpine trip last year. It weighs 230 grams and it runs off AA batteries, and it's got a touch typeable keyboard. So it was absolutely the ideal device for me because I could touch type on it. The AA batteries, the first set lasted for 7 weeks and the second set I didn't wear out. It works, it chatters like a fax machine with any telephone that you care to use it with, so most of the time I use my own mobile. It cost, when I was wittering on a lot on the blog, it probably cost me about 35, 40 pence to transmit the blog to the cost of the phone call.
Did that go straight to your blog then, or did it to somebody else and they then put it on the blog for you?
No, that went direct to the blog. Because I'm with Blogger, I can email to the blog, and all this device will do is email text. So I'd type the text, I'd email it to my blog address, and it'd go straight up onto the blog.
Brilliant.
And if my telephone wouldn't work, then I could use a payphone to send it.
And it's got an acoustic modem in, I presume?
Yeah, it you can actually hear it chattering. In the same way as you can hear a dial-up modem or a fax machine chattering.
Brilliant. And then what, an MP3 player? Anything else that we sort of have mentioned at all?
Yeah, we had an MP3 player each, which all that we had on there. I had a couple of podcasts from my favourite outdoor station.
Yay!
And we both had audiobooks on there, which my audiobook saw me through the whole trip. Mick got through a few more than I did. Head torches, you mentioned we took head torches. Mick used his head torch once on the entire trip for about 2 minutes.
Wow.
And I used mine a handful of times when a campsite actually had a book I could read, and I read Beyond Dark. But the head torches got very, very little use. Other electronics, we had to take a phone charger because we were out so long, but we opted not to go with any sort of a solar charger or anything. We just made sure we didn't use the phones enough to wear them down. And the battery life on mine turned out to be almost inexhaustible.
Well, that's excellent. Well, we've taken enough of your time now, and it's been fascinating to certainly hear all the details. You were, of course, doing the walk in aid of Macmillan Cancer Support, and I see that you've just gone over your target of 4,250 and got 4,285.30. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is encourage anybody that's listened to this, and certainly that gets you will while away hours looking through the days and days and days of information on the very excellent and eloquent blog. So please, if you do that, to actually make a small contribution. I'm sure Mick and Gail would appreciate that to keep the charity fund increasing. On the subject of money, the one thing that always crosses my mind when people do sort of trips is actually what it physically costs in hard cash to actually travel for that length of time through the country. Do you sort of roughly have an idea of what it cost you?
At this moment, I have no idea. However, we wrote down every penny that we spent on the way. So once I've gathered in all my notebooks that are scattered in places, I didn't want to trust my notebooks to Royal Mail. So once I've gathered those in, I will actually do all the sums as to what we spent on what, and I will put on the blog how much it cost. I actually glanced at my original budget this morning, and my feeling is that we've come in under the budget, but I don't know that until I've gathered those in and actually worked out what we did spend.
One thing that would affect that, of course, which you did touch on, I just want to just come to that if we may, is the dehydrated food. Obviously, you prepared a lot of the food, if not, I don't know, all of it, perhaps, for the trip itself. Now, food dehydrators do save an incredible amount of money, but did all the recipes work? And you know, is there a very swift and successful way you have now in your system of reconstituting food?
I'm pleased to say all the recipes for this trip worked. We've certainly had some previously that didn't work, but we'd all the ones we used on this trip we had tried and tested before, and we certainly learnt on this trip which recipes you can add smash to and which it just doesn't taste right. We actually did it all very quickly in the rehydrating. We, depending on what the water source was, we either boiled the water first or just threw the water and the food in the pan together. Just brought it to the boil, threw it into the pot cosy. I didn't mention the pot cosy earlier, very integral part of the cooking system, which saved huge amounts of gas and you know, just time sitting with it over a flame. So we put it in the pot cosy, left it for 20 minutes, half an hour, depending on what else we were doing. And it was still... And it was generally ready to eat. I think the only thing that took longer and maybe didn't reconstitute as well was Mick had some chicken dishes. But other than that, the 20 minutes in the pot cosy, having just boiled them up, and they were ready to eat.
Fantastic. Any particular foods that you could just quickly go through that worked quicker than others, just to give people an idea of how to use the dehydrated food?
Well, all of my menu was veggie food. And anything with lentils that's lentil-based rehydrates really, really quickly. Veggie pasta sauces, you know, literally tomatoes, herbs and chopped Mediterranean vegetables, again, rehydrate in not very long at all. As I already mentioned, chicken takes an absolute age. But minced beef, minced lamb, you know, shepherd's pie and chilies and bolognese is all rehydrated very quickly. Chickpeas take a while. Did find myself some nights getting a little bit impatient and crunching through the chickpeas.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you had the same experience as myself. That definitely the chickens and the sort of the white meat that tends to take a long time, whereas red meat does come back together very, very, very quickly.
Yes. So definitely worth having the dehydrator, definitely worth dehydrating our own meals from the point of view of we knew what was in them, we knew what was on the menu, and from the fact that I'm fussy, it meant that I always knew I could have something that I would want to eat.
You were always happy.
I was. And there's nothing quite like getting in the tent at the end of a day, particularly when it's been a miserable day and it's been cold. You get in, you dry your feet off, you put something nice and warm on your jacket and some dry socks, and you have yourself a nice warm meal. And no matter what's happened in the day, even the nightmare assault course through a forest, everything becomes right with the world.
One piece of kit we didn't mention was rucksacks. What were the two rucksacks you were both wearing, and did they do the trick?
Mick was wearing an Osprey Atmos 50, He's had it for probably a couple of years now. He was perfectly happy with that, no problems with it. I think he'll be replacing it with the same when it wears out. I had the OMM Villain MSC. Loved it. It was comfortable, apart from a small issue with my left shoulder. It had all the pockets I needed, did everything I needed it to. I think the only complaint I would make about it is that using my Thermarest in the back pocket, which, because mine's not the three-quarter Thermarest, it was a bit of a technique to actually get it into the pocket happily. And I hadn't covered it with anything, so when it rained, my Thermarest did get wet. But it never caused a problem because, you know, we'd throw it in the tent, and by the time it was bedtime, it was dry anyway, because obviously they don't retain water here. It dried out quickly.
Brilliant. Well, Gail, thank you very much indeed for taking the time to have a chat with us about this, and congratulations once again to you and Mick for completing your target and raising a fair amount of funds for Macmillan Cancer Support. And as I say, if people are listening to this, please do pop along to the website and make a small contribution, because it's all going to a good cause, and if you were doing the same thing, I'm sure you would like people to contribute as well. So all I'll wait and do now is find out what the next trip's going to be, and perhaps have a chat with you when you prepare for that one.
Okay, I'll keep you posted.
Thanks to Gail and the very quiet Mick in the background for sharing their experience in such detail. As I say, Gail's blog is a brilliant read, and if you ever want to lose a few hours and escape, you won't be disappointed. There will be a link to the blog on the Outdoor Station website next to this podcast, or just type in Mick and Gail, spelt with a Y, into Google and you'll find it right there. Until next time, folks, take care, get out and get some fresh air, and enjoy the rest of the summer.
This independent programme is produced and hosted by theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.